Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights and Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Groups, was recorded on Friday, February 13, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing the sue and settle phenomenon specifically within the context of the Endangered Species Act. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of our experts in turn, in the order in which I'm about to introduce them. They'll each speak for about 5 to 8 minutes, after which we're going to have a little back and forth, but then, as always, we'll be turning to the audience for your questions. We will hear first today from Mr. William Yeatman. He's a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute here in Washington, D.C. He will be followed by Professor Justin Padeau of the University of Denver Sturm College of Law. And then we'll conclude our opening remarks with the Honorable Susan Combs. She's a former Comptroller of Public Accounts for the state of Texas. And with that, Mr. Yeatman, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. Again, my name is William Yeatman. I'm a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. We're a free market think tank here in Washington, D.C., so that's what we're all about. I work on environmental regulation. And so on to sue and settle. So notwithstanding the obvious benefits to judicial economy afforded by settlements to cases and controversies, the term sue and settle refers to a very real public policy problem. On the one hand, this problem sometimes manifests itself in seemingly collusive policymaking negotiations between federal agencies and special interests under the auspices of Article III courts. And I've got examples to this end. If anyone would like to discuss that further, let me know. But that's not the subject today. Today I want to discuss sue and settle in its most pervasive form. And here I'm talking about sue and settle as a process by which special interests can seize the reins of federal policymaking. And this is exactly what has happened with the Endangered Species Act. It's important to understand at the outset that sue and settle is fundamentally a statutory problem. This is Congress's error, or it originates or stems from a congressional mistake. And indeed, sue and settle arises from the interaction of two phenomena common to environmental laws. And the first is an overabundance of non-discretionary duties. And by this, I just mean that in many environmental laws, the Congress has given federal agencies far more responsibilities than they have the resources to handle. The second phenomenon that leads to sue and settle are so-called agency-forcing citizen suits. And what these are provisions that empower individuals or special interests to sue agencies that are out of compliance with their non-discretionary duties in order to compel them to perform these duties. So independently, an overabundance of mandatory duties and citizen suit litigation aren't necessarily problematic. Together, however, they are, and here's why. If the agency is overwhelmed with responsibilities, then special interest groups can sue to pick among the agency's duties, or outstanding duties, I should say. In the face of these suits, agencies settle. Because they really don't have a legal leg to stand on. I mean, it's the statute, the underlying commands overwhelm the agency and are far beyond what can be performed. They're irrational, but nonetheless, they're the plain text of the statute. So they're compelled to settle. So in this fashion, between these two provisions, the dynamic thereof, special interests can establish the agency's priorities. Well, here's the problem. It's that establishing priorities for an agency with limited resources is no different than policymaking. And I question whether or not it is proper for special interest, for whom there is no electoral accountability, to have such a large part in setting policy. Here's how it works for the Endangered Species Act, just a bare-bones overview. So groups can petition the Fish and Wildlife Service to consider species for ESA protections. There is no limit on the number of petitions that a group can bring. These petitions, in turn, engender non-discretionary duties for the Fish and Wildlife Service. They've got certain time frames with which to process and make determinations pursuant to these petitions. So finally, groups can then sue to press the agency to perform these non-discretionary duties. And indeed, really, the recent ESA history plainly demonstrates this dynamic. I guess the large heavy hand that these groups, that environmental special interests in particular, are playing with regard to establishing the Fish and Wildlife Service's ESA priorities. So a specific historical example, one I'm sure many listeners on this call are aware of, is from 2007 to 2011, a handful of green or environmentalist special interest filed citizen suit, filed petitions, ESA petitions, regarding more than 1,200 petitions, 1,200 species. Fish and Wildlife Service was completely overwhelmed. I mean, ultimately, these groups sued to press their case for these 1,200 petitions. Fish and Wildlife Service, again, overwhelmed, accordingly goes to the negotiating table. As a result of the settlement agreement thus engendered, the next 6 years of Fish and Wildlife Service ESA priorities were established. I mean, literally the 6 years of what they have to do. And again, the extent to which these priorities were dictated by environmental special interest is perhaps best evident in the commonality shared by five species given highest priority in one of these two major settlement agreements. One was with Wild Earth Guardians, the other was with the Center for Biological Diversity. These five species, and I've got a list of them over here. It's like the New Mexico jumping mouse, the greater sage grouse, the Sonoran desert tortoise, the Canadian lynx. So these ones were given priority within this settlement agreement. I mean, what do they all share in common? Well, their critical habitat happens to coincide major oil and gas producing regions in the Southwest and along the Rocky Mountains. So given the anti-fossil fuel bent of the plaintiffs, you know, the Wild Earth Guardians and the Center for Biological Diversities of the world, it stands to reason that political considerations were paramount in establishing their priorities. I mean, they're part of these settlement discussions. So that to me is troubling, the extent to which they can, to which, I mean, the federal government's priorities are going to be a function of special interest priorities. I find that troubling, and I'm not alone. This has indeed been, I mean, from the Clinton administration, the George W. Bush administration, indeed the Obama administration, has all conceded the Fish and Wildlife Service that this is a major problem, the extent to which special interests can dictate their priorities. So that's the problem. I'll note, and we can discuss this at length in the Q&A and the back and forth and whatnot, I was tasked with discussing congressional solutions. And indeed, there actually is one in place. It doesn't pertain to that super settlement agreement that I talked about earlier with the 1,200-odd species and the five oil and gas-specific species. But for subsequent petitions regarding Fish and Wildlife Service's processing thereof, the Congress has actually established a cap, a $1.5 million budget cap, on the extent to which the Fish and Wildlife Service can establish its priorities pursuant to future petitions. So that's a fascinating congressional solution to this particular problem, this particular manifestation of sue and settle, of having special interests dictate agency priorities. I don't think it'll necessarily translate into I don't think it would work, say, for other statutes where this is a problem, for example, the Clean Air Act, but nonetheless, this was news to me as of 2 weeks ago that Congress could actually find agreement on something, you know, this seemingly divisive. So regarding congressional solutions for this particular problem, there actually already is one in the books. So that's the problem. That is a novel congressional solution that I had been ignorant of until very recently. And with that, I will pass the baton to the professor.
Great. Thanks very much, Will. And thank you to the Federalist Society for inviting me to participate in this. What will no doubt be a lively debate and discussion. More background about me. So I teach environmental law and property at the University of Denver Sturm College of Law. And before joining the Sturm College of Law, I was an appellate lawyer at the Department of Justice in the Environment and Natural Resources Division. I did not work on any of the ESA cases that we will be discussing. People in the office that I worked in participated in various facets of those cases, but I come to this issue with virtually no insider information that I might inadvertently share, so that's a nice place to be. I guess I'll begin by questioning whether or not there really is a sue and settle phenomenon at all. I mean, interestingly, I think Mr. Yeatman and I share some common ground. He says the problem here is with Congress, and I agree that there are some problems with Congress. Congress has tasked agencies, environmental agencies in particular, with a whole host of non-discretionary duties. It has provided for citizen involvement in those decisions, whether they be from environmental groups, industry groups, individual citizens. There are means by which people can petition for the listing of a species, and they can also petition for the delisting of a species. And then Congress has also given the agency not nearly enough money to actually complete the task before it, right? And so we do have this confluence, and I think this is perhaps the area of agreement, between mandatory duties, lots of citizen involvement, and very limited funds. And it does put the Fish and Wildlife Service in something of a bind. Now, the reason I say I don't think there's a sue and settle phenomenon is that I don't think that the settlements at issue are particularly noteworthy. The issue here is not that the federal government entered into a settlement. Had the federal government not entered into a settlement, then the Fish and Wildlife Service would be operating pursuant to decrees issued by judges in various circuits and district courts. Those decrees would be conflicting. They would establish timelines that the agency has very little control over, and indeed the priorities of the agency would be set by judges, rather than the priorities of the agency being set for it by the lawyers of the agency negotiating a settlement. And negotiating a settlement is obviously a very difficult and tricky endeavor. I want to speak briefly about how that works if you're a lawyer at the federal government, and why I think there are ample constraints within the federal government to avoid, in almost all circumstances, the kind of collusive dynamics that Mr. Yeatman mentioned, although didn't go into detail about. So if you're if you're the federal government, and a lawsuit comes in, immediately the action agency is no longer, so when I say the action agency, in this case the Fish and Wildlife Service, whoever the actual defendant is, that agency is in some sense no longer in control of the case before it. There's a Department of Justice lawyer who's immediately assigned to the case, and indeed it's the Department of Justice which has ultimate authority over settlement, over litigation strategy, and indeed even over which issues are presented to the court. Now, there can be feedback from the agency, and there of course always is, but indeed it's the Department of Justice lawyers who are chiefly in charge of these issues, and they are by and large long-serving career lawyers who may have worked on an area before but are not specifically invested in the programmatic objectives of the agency. So what does that lawyer do? Well, they assess their legal vulnerability, and as Mr. Yeatman suggested, the legal vulnerability in the cases under the ESA is essentially 100%. The federal government will lose these cases, and they will lose a lot of these cases, and the end result will be an injunction against the Fish and Wildlife Service. I mean, that is the looking forward analysis that a Department of Justice lawyer would do in the light of a lawsuit of this sort. And so what do? Well, you talk with the agency about whether or not you can come up with a way to settle the case and maximize the agency's ability to have the time it needs to do its work and to pursue the priorities that it would like to pursue. And indeed, the specific settlements that sort of are at the core of this discussion are two settlements that were entered into through multi-district litigation, involved a lot of species, a lot of lawsuits, and the agency's approach here was very sensible. It said, we are being sued all the time. Let's see if we can come up with a way to limit the number of future lawsuits that are filed against us, so that we can actually do the work that is before us. And there was a lengthy negotiation through which the agency agreed, compromised, to engage in a schedule for reaching certain decisions, and the plaintiffs agreed to limit the number of future lawsuits that they would file, allowing the agency to complete the work that Congress has entrusted to it, rather than spend all of its time defending itself in court, which has surely been the experience of Fish and Wildlife Service staff well before 2007. I mean, that has been the experience of the Fish and Wildlife Service for much of the time that it has been engaged in listing species. And so to my mind, this is an incredibly sensible approach that the federal government takes. It takes the approach in order to maximize the agency's ability to influence its priorities, pursue its priorities in the absence of arbitrary decisions by a cross-section of judges throughout the country. It allows the agency to minimize the amount of fees that are going to be paid, protecting the taxpayer, and it allows the agency to protect itself to some degree from future litigation. And I submit to you that that is not a problematic approach from the government's perspective, but rather a very sensible and praiseworthy approach. With that, I don't know how my timing went, but I will turn it over to the Honorable Susan Combs.
Well, thank you so much for having us all on, and I'm going to take a slightly different task. I just finished an 8-year term as an elected official of the State Comptroller of Public Accounts, which really is responsible for a lot of the economic picture of the state treasurer and tax collector. And so prior to that, I was 8 years also elected as the Agriculture Commissioner. So the Endangered Species Act, from an economic perspective, has been very important in the state of Texas. And I'm going to come back to sort of the petition to put this in a little bit of perspective. Since about 2007, as Mr. Yeatman mentioned, the number of petitions has soared. And in those few years, it was more than the prior 30 years. And we do agree that there is, of course, a sort of overwhelming amount of material they cannot deal with. But what was also interesting to me was that the interested party definition is basically anybody. So the Fish and Wildlife Service boat was swamped. But that also, that boat was sort of swamped in some sense. People couldn't find out what was going on. And the legal options were limited to somebody on the outside until after the species was listed, because you couldn't sue, although the petitions were there, and then it was sort of virtually too late. It's very, very, very hard to overturn a listing. And of course, the third point I would say is that it's not easy to find out which species are up. And we have there was a website that we created called www.keepingtexasfirst.org, and I assigned staff to read the Federal Register every day, and I asked folks in Washington if there were a central list. I've asked in an email, I've asked in writing. The email said, no, there is no central list. The letter said, yes, there is. Well, there is not a central list, but we have a list. But why do we want a list? So we can deal with whatever's coming down the regulatory pike. And in Texas, we have 254 counties. Not a single Texas county is without a species. And that means that if you're the county judge or you're a rancher or whatever, you're not quite sure what to do next. So let me talk about two case studies which we think illustrate a process that works. Fort Hood is a very large military institution between Austin and Dallas, and it's very large, and it's for the Army. And they had two birds, the Golden Cheek Warbler, Black Cap Vireo, which were listed, and the question was, what was the military going to do? Turns out that their defense activities were going to be limited because they had tanks and they were going to tear up habitat. The 47,000 plus acres of habitat was restricted, but there was insufficient data to demonstrate that the restriction needed to be that large. And I led an effort as Ag Commissioner to create something called the Recovery Credit System. And we brought in agriculture, Department of Defense, landowners, et cetera, and some NGOs. And it became sort of a national model because it was voluntary. The installation needed to have habitat protected for the birds so they would not run afoul of their obligations. And the ranchers on the outside agreed to stop, you know, tearing up stuff, and they would let all the plants and habitat continue. And Department of Defense paid them sort of like the Conservation Reserve Program under the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And because it was voluntary and market-driven, the cost for these units of credit went down by about 50%. And so the data that was produced upon the fort and the surrounding area showed that the birds were thriving, and that has been very, very good. And their efforts will be underway shortly to propose delisting. The second was the dune sagebrush lizard, and that was a lizard that was of some controversy. It's out in the Permian Basin, which is one of the hottest oil and gas areas in the United States, and I was the Comptroller of Public Accounts, and I was asked to see what I could do to prevent the listing of this. And what was key was we did not have enough data. And when you don't know what's coming down the pike, particularly you don't know where to go, which priority, which species, in order to get data to be able to rebut a proposal for listing. Well, in this particular case, we were lucky. There were 21 scientists who were found and paid for across all of the universities, both inside Texas and out, and they did a huge amount of surveying. The lizard is very active until about mid-July. And so they went out of a six-week period and surveyed all of the areas, all the habitat they could find in these five counties, and they found a whole bunch of lizards. And what they were able to do with my help and some others, we created a voluntary, market-driven, confidential program. And this is, of course, a private land state. About 97% of Texas is privately owned. And we created a proposal, the Texas Conservation Plan, that Fish and Wildlife accepted. Well, we were then, the Fish and Wildlife was sued by the Center for Biological Diversity and Wild Earth Guardians, and I was granted intervener status as having standing because we were the permit holder. We were successful in September, just a year ago, being able to propose to fend off, sorry, 6 months ago, to be able to fend off the allegations that the plan was not good, and the federal district court in the District of Columbia said that our plan was very robust, that the data gathering was excellent, and that the verification was very, very good. And so I guess what I would say is we have a couple of lessons learned. Number one is you're going to have to get your science, and you're just going to have to do it and get ahead of it. And number two, whatever you do, I think it's going to have to be voluntary and easy to understand. And that was lessons we learned from both Fort Hood and the lizard. And again, the reason why the Permian Basin was so important, about 47,000 jobs, and that area produces 14% of the U.S. crude oil output. So it was a pretty big deal. And the third thing is, of course, you've got to have so many stakeholders as possible. Well, when it comes back to the issue of science, the court affirmed the fact that we had done a great deal of science. And so what I proposed was in our last legislative session in 2013, I put together a science fund, a $5 million science fund. And because of this flood of petitions, we didn't know who was on first. So we set up a process, a three-metric system to determine where we would put our science dollars first. First question was, do we know anything about it? If we do, it doesn't get the science. We want to go where there is no science. Secondly, what's the economic impact? High impact, fund it. No impact, don't fund it. And thirdly, urgency. If there's a decision going to be made tomorrow, it's too late. We had to have time to get the decision together. So we have now rolled out, before I left just 6 weeks ago, four requests for proposals covering every single county in the state with about $2.5 or $3 trillion of economic impact if they're listed. And we have these four rounds of proposals, and I think it's unique in the nation for doing this because it was my view that every state has an interest in protecting its economy and that you do want sound science. On that website, keepingtexasfirst.org, we have all of the data on how we have conflict of interest provisions in there, how we have every single state university system is at the table and can participate. We have outside of the state reviewers to vet the proposals so that we don't get sort of gamed by something. And I am a firm believer that you can protect the species and protect the economy if you are willing to do the hard work. But you have to get to the science because I do think this incredible flood of petitions, they are in many cases not backed by science. They're simply thrown in there, but under the rather draconian statutory requirements of the ESA, you have to respond as the federal agency. And when we were granted intervener status, I think it was very helpful. Fish and Wildlife was very glad that we did, and we hired counsel for our agency and were able to participate. So at least in two cases, we've been, I think, successful in making a good outcome with a tough statute.
Well, thank you very much, everyone. Those are interesting opening remarks. We want to get to audience questions as soon as possible, so let's let people begin to queue up before we look for some responses or back and forth here. So in a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we do that, let me ask a question of any of our panelists, really, and let me start with actually William Yeatman. What sort of, we've heard economic perspective mentioned here and costs and economic analysis. What sort of, on the front end, cost-benefit analysis is required, or is there any requirement in either listing a species or a habitat under the Endangered Species Act?
To be perfectly honest with you, I am going to defer to the professor and to Susan. So I know that there's a list of criteria that must be taken into account for each of these decisions. But off the top of my head, it's 5 for 1 and 4 for the other. Would one of my co-panelists please help me out here to the extent to which economic considerations are allowed to be taken into account for these listing determinations?
Well, I'm certainly happy to offer my view on that question. I think different administrations have taken somewhat different views, but I think the statute makes it relatively clear that that there isn't a cost-benefit analysis that goes into the listing decision, that the listing decision is supposed to be made based on a determination as to the likelihood of the species going extinct, and that if it is likely to go extinct, then it should be listed, and if not, then not. Now, that doesn't mean that all of the things that Susan was talking about aren't taken into account, because those things go to the question of whether or not the species is likely to become extinct, whether there are processes in place, voluntary or otherwise, that are likely to result in conservation of the species in the absence of a listing. And so all that goes into the question, but I don't think that there is a straight-up cost-benefit analysis that the Fish and Wildlife Service could engage in deciding, well, we're not going to list this species because even though we are ruling on the petition and the science says it's going to become extinct, we're going to say we're not going to list it anyway. We're going to make a not warranted finding.
I would agree, and what I would say is that in the listing, it's supposed to be in the critical habitat, but I at least have some issues with how they propose to determine sort of the baseline harm. The point I was making is my view is different. As comptroller, I had an obligation to take a look at the economic impact of a regulatory burden, and we were aware that it was so serious for the state of Texas, we had to get ahead of it. And when my view is that the petitions are, generally speaking, not supported by particularly good data, and we needed to have good data. And if the data was going to show that a species was in imminent harm, then that, so be it. Then that's what you have to go with. You have to go with the information. But the economic issue was ours, and I think it enabled us to get the legislature to say, yep, this is a big deal, and we need to fund science.
Yeah, and let me just tag on one thing to that. This is Justin Pinto again. I think that's absolutely right, that is the place that economics play. Economics are a huge motivator to develop voluntary conservation and to develop the science, because the Fish and Wildlife Service lacks the staff to actually do the science themselves. What they're required to do under Section 4 of the Endangered Species Act is consider the best science that is available. And so I think if you're in a municipality, a locality where you're worried about a listing decision, developing science, good science with respect to this particular species, is absolutely one of the most proactive things you can do, because it may well turn out that the threat is less than previously thought, in which case that information will be considered and a finding that listing is not warranted is more likely.
If I might just jump in there real quick, ask the professor a question. So if science is supposed to be the lodestar, do you have any concerns, given that groups that wear their politics on their sleeve have such a large influence? I mean, the interlocutors with the government in terms of establishing these priorities? To me, again, that example I gave of the 5 species that were given priority within the priority making of the settlement agreement with the Wild Earth Guardians, they all come from oil and gas regions. I mean, is that, to me, that the 5 species they give most priority to out of 1,200, that their habitat happens to correspond in a very controversial manner with oil and gas production, suggests that, again, political concerns were at play. And of course, political concerns are going to be divorced from scientific concerns.
Well, let me distinguish something, at least in my view. I don't think that science has to just drive the priorities decision. It drives the listing decision. And so, I mean, under this settlement, the agency did not commit to list. They committed to decide to list. And indeed, in a number of circumstances pursuant to the settlement, they have returned a finding that listing was not warranted. They looked at the petition, they looked at the science that was available, and they said, you know what, there isn't enough, the evidence doesn't suggest that the species should be endangered or should be threatened. That's the appropriate place for the science to cold, hard facts to be the driving force.
And that was what they did in Texas. They found not warranted because we had very good science.
Right, and that's been true in Arizona, and that's been true in Georgia. I mean, there's a number of places where there have been species that have not been listed as a result of, you know, under the settlement agreement. And at the point that the agency, is moving forward on species, I mean, one of the interesting parts about these settlements is perhaps they actually are providing much more notice than people would ordinarily have, right? There really is a list of species coming down the pike in just the way that Susan was describing now. I mean, of course, the agency might consider other species too, but at least with respect to these species, there are some publicly available timelines that people can use to try to generate the science that they want.
Let me interject one other thing. So you have your multi-district litigation, you have species and species and species, but then in addition, there has been no cessation of the individual petitions which come out of no place. The bay skipper butterfly and then the plain spotted skunk. For example, the plain spotted skunk covers about a third of the United States, and it came out of a petition in Illinois. I don't know where the bay skipper butterfly came out of, but these just come out of absolutely nowhere. And so when you think you've got your eye on the settlement list, then all of a sudden there's a proliferation of other ones, and I will tell you, it keeps people breathless trying to keep up.
I will note just on that with respect to the comment about how the settlement agreements perhaps provide a clear roadmap for the public to engage in this issue and to learn about what species are in play. I haven't found that to be the case at all. I mean, there's a lot of cross-reference in those settlement agreements, and indeed, according to one major participant in, I mean, he wrote a law review article, and I've got his name right here, but according to him, he said in essence that it was unclear to even the parties involved, at least at the Fish and Wildlife Service, how many species were ultimately at issue with regard to these two super settlement agreements with Wild Earth Guardians and the Center for Biological Diversity. So I'm not. There seems to be a contrary view out there amongst an interested party who is indeed a stakeholder to all this, who suggests the opposite, that it hasn't really brought clarity. And I think that Susan, mentioned, or her comments touched upon that, just the confusion in terms of being able to identify which species are at play.
We, in fact, we did a contract with NatureServ trying to get an up-to-date list, and we had to do extensive footnoting, we're not sure, we can't find out, we're not sure, and this is hiring a bunch of people to do the work. It is absolutely, if you're trying to deal with this on a statewide basis, it is very difficult.
And are you speaking now of the list of currently endangered species or the list under consideration?
The ones that's already listed, that's known. Obviously,
right.
Really. But the ones under consideration, that is very problematic. Go take a look
right.
at the website, keepingtexasfirst.org, and you don't know. The problem is if you're trying to get ahead of it and you at the state have limited resources, how do you know which guy or gal or lizard or plant or aquatic species is coming next? It is very hard to find out.
And we're saying this is all – go ahead, Professor. I'm sorry.
I was going to make one follow-up comment, and I don't disagree with what either Will or Susan said, that new species come out of the blue all the time because new people can make petitions all the time, right? I mean, these settlements were between the Fish and Wildlife Service and the two groups that most frequently file petitions and have been most frequently the litigators in these cases, but there are – you as an individual, anyone on this phone can put together a petition, file it with the Fish and Wildlife Service, and trigger all of the requirements of doing a 90-day finding and a 12-month finding.
Right. And so that continues to happen, and I think it probably blindsides the Fish and Wildlife Service some of the time. The point I did want to make, though, is at least with respect to some species, I think it's hard to argue that the settlement is not clear. I mean, the settlement specifically lists a number of species and dates certain by which a determination can be made. So, for example, the Joyful Plateau Salamander must be determined during fiscal year 2012. I mean, that is in some of the provisions of the settlement agreement. Now, that settlement agreement doesn't specify dates for every species that might be implicated. I think that's probably right, but at least with respect to some. And let me also say, I don't think this is the primary benefit of these settlements, but I do think that they provide a degree of notice that is a salutary side benefit of them being publicly available documents. Now, the question of whether or not there should be some other more streamlined fashion by which the Fish and Wildlife Service is maintaining a publicly available list of petitions, I think, goes beyond the question of the settlements themselves. It's probably a question more about resources the Fish and Wildlife Service has to develop and maintain that list. I certainly don't see a problem with doing so. If Congress would appropriate the money for the Fish and Wildlife Service to do that, that seems like a sensible thing to have happen.
Are we talking in this unknowable list that we're talking about, are we talking about dozens of species, hundreds, thousands? I mean, is there a range?
Certainly hundreds.
Yeah,
hundreds. Certainly
hundreds. Hundreds and hundreds.
Okay.
I wrote a letter to Secretary Jewell, whom I had a great visit with about, that I wrote a letter to her in the fall, and I got a letter back and said, yes, we have a list. Well, tain't so. There ain't no list.
Is there a petition process for delisting species that folks on the other side of these issues could utilize?
There is a process, but it's not simple. In fact, for example, up at Fort Hood, these two birds, we believe that we have enough data. The birds are everywhere that we can start the process, but you have to get the science. And again, if I can't demonstrate to you that these birds are, you know, flying and singing every place, then I cannot go ahead and get the data together. So it's a never-ending, it's an appropriate process to keep going after the science, but it's time-consuming, and you've got to have the funds for it.
I mean, I think the petition process is the same, but it's still under the same sections of Section 4. But that it's absolutely true that it is very difficult to meet the statutory requirements for actually achieving a delisting.
Are the burdens of proof the same? Do they run in the same direction for the delisting petition as they do for the listing petition?
Well, I want to give you an example of the cactus pygmy, the ferruginous cactus pygmy owl. That was proposed in 1993 by CBD to be listed. It's in South Texas, and it was listed in about 98, 99, whatever. And then they were sued. Finally, once it was listed, they could actually go into court and say, "Not so fast! You don't have it right." By about 2006, it was taken off of the list. The following year, it was put back on one of the petitions. It's now back on. It's been 20 years, and this little pygmy owl, it's back on, proposed to be studied again. And that is just an extraordinary effort. It's just it's a war of attrition on this little owl.
We've got about 20 minutes or so left. We've got three callers with questions who've been waiting patiently. Before we turn to them, let me just make a quick commercial announcement about our upcoming teleform conference calls. This list is always subject to change, mostly by addition of new calls. But next Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern time, we'll be talking about Too Big to Fail and Single Point of Entry. We did a teleform on this a few weeks ago, and this is a responsive teleform, people with different views presenting on Tuesday. That's 1 p.m. Eastern time. On Wednesday at 2 p.m. Eastern time, we'll be talking about an important new book. Its title is Saving Congress from Itself, written by former Senator and former Judge James Buckley. That's Wednesday at 2 p.m. And then on Friday, our topic will be civil asset forfeiture, a close look at that, Friday at 1 p.m. For now, of course, we're talking about the Sue and Settle and Endangered Species Act. Let's go to our first caller question of the day.
Hi, this is Brian Seacholz from the Reason Foundation. Thank you very much for having this forum. I just want a couple comments because there's some discussion about how many species we're talking about, and it is a big problem. I mean, the Center for Biological Diversity says there's 757 of these lawsuit settlement species. Wild Earth Guardians, I think, has said there are about 838. So I don't know which one. I contacted the Fish and Wildlife Service Division of Endangered Species. I asked them, and they don't know. They can't come up with a definitive number. And this shouldn't be something that's very difficult. They should be able to keep a centralized database on this. So that's just one sort of point of information. Another one is about burdens of proof between listing and delisting. The burden for, of proof for listing, I think, is relatively low. The burden of proof for delisting is incredibly high. A couple examples. The three most common species of kangaroo in Australia, which are like white-tailed deer, were listed under the Endangered Species Act in 1974, were not delisted until 1994, despite the strenuous efforts of the Australian government to convince the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that, in fact, the red, eastern gray, and western gray kangaroos were nowhere near endangered. So this can be a very difficult process. A second thing, I just wanted to take a little bit of issue with Professor Pito, that he seemed to say Fish and Wildlife Service was somewhat amenable to this process of this lawsuit settlement. And I think, in fact, the Fish and Wildlife Service is very unhappy with this because their hands are tied and they're not, they've lost control of the listing process. There's a very good article in High Country News for anybody who's interested about this called Extreme Green by Ted Williams that was on May 31st, 2011. It's available online. And Jamie Rappaport-Clark, who was the head of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, makes comments about this and says how Center for Biological Diversity and Wild Earth Guardians are essentially seem to be in a competition to see who can file the most lawsuits. And I think that cuts to a larger point, and this gets back to what Comptroller Combs has done in Texas, is that to recognize that these lawsuits and these listing petitions are not really about the conservation of species. This is about achieving a process. This is about using this as a fundraising tool. It's trying to get some money through the Equal Access to Justice Act. And I think that what happened in Texas with the dune sagebrush lizard is very instructive. I mean, Comptroller Combs and folks in Texas put together a dynamite conservation plan. They did their own research. They conserved the lizard. They got a not warranted listing, which that's great. Everybody's happy about that. But the people who weren't happy about it was Center for Biological Diversity, Defenders of Wildlife, and some other folks. And so I think that, you know, one of the problems that crops up with this sue and settle phenomenon is that it really plays into the hands of these groups that are really not substantively interested in conservation, but they just want to use the Endangered Species Act as a weapon, as a tool. And I'll just leave my comment
okay.
There.
Professor Pito, do you want to respond?
Sure, just a couple of quick responses. I have to admit I did not see the article that was referenced, so it's possible that the frustration was expressed with the settlements. I suspect, however, that the frustration was expressed with the number of petitions and lawsuits that are filed. There is absolutely frustration at the Fish and Wildlife Service, very long-standing frustration at the Fish and Wildlife Service, about the number of petitions and the number of lawsuits that they're facing, because from their perspective, they can't do their job, right? If CBD, if Wild Earth Guardians, if a particular group wants them to actually be processing and making good determinations about listings, they need some space, right? They need to not face a new petition every day and a new lawsuit every month. And I think, indeed, the settlement was an effort to try to achieve that space to some degree. Not a perfect tool, not a perfect result. Settlements never are. But that was the motivation. And Fish and Wildlife Service, I do know, was very involved in negotiating the settlement. They were very interested in trying to resolve this through multi-district litigation so that they could put all these cases together and try to resolve them at one time in a way that would allow them to move forward. The other thing I'll just say, and I mean, I interacted with people at CBD when I was at the Department of Justice and Wild Earth Guardians. I continue to do so. I don't agree with many of their priorities. I agree with some of them. I do believe that most of the people there are ideologically very committed to species conservation. This is, to them, a moral calling, and I think that causes them to make very poor strategic decisions sometimes. But I do think that it's a genuinely felt moral viewpoint. And indeed, I mean, the people at CBD and Wild Earth Guardians, part of the problem that they run into, and the reasons that they're challenging sort of everything the Fish and Wildlife Service does, especially when it makes a not warranted decision, is that they don't think the government is actually trustworthy, right? They don't think that government scientists are trustworthy in much the same way that the economic interests don't tend to think that the government scientists are trustworthy. And so Fish and Wildlife Service is really caught in between these two poles of sort of deeply felt sincere beliefs and a lot of suspicion and mistrust directed at the agency. And to the best, you know, when I worked with Fish and Wildlife Service, I thought they were muddling through as best as they could, given all the constraints that have been placed on them through congressional command and limited appropriations.
If I might just leap on there real quick, just ask the professor, do you have any problems whatsoever with a group, with these groups? And again, I 100% agree with you. They mean what they say. They are passionate. But I just doubt those passions perhaps are in line with those of the average American voter, or indeed the overwhelming preponderance of American voters. So, I mean, do you have any qualms whatsoever with this group and its dedication and its passion having such an outsized role in the formulation of federal agency policy priorities?
I mean, I come back to Congress created a series of statutes that invite citizen participation. Congress did so. These groups are taking advantage of it in exactly the same way that economic interests take advantage of other vehicles by which they can force agencies to respond to their interests and concerns, whether it be through filing permits, permit applications coupled with unreasonable delay suits and the like. You know, the federal government and the way that we have crafted the administrative state involves a lot of non-governmental entities having influence in one way or another. Now, if we were starting from scratch across the board, would I think this is the best way? I don't know. I think it's, you know, it's like Churchill said, right? Democracy is the worst form of government except everything else we've thought of. I think that might be true here, too, that, yes, it does create risks by which, whether it be a particular economic interest, a particular environmental interest, you know, you name your group that can have influence that may diverge from the elected, sort of the viewpoints of the elected, sort of the electorate. That's the system that we've created, and I think there are political checks that are built in. That's why we have elections.
Now, the fact that the Congress does find it problematic, as is evidenced by the Obama administration's request that Congress cap FWS's budget at $1.5 million to establish their priorities pursuant to these settlement agreements, given that the president who was elected by the people and the Congress, who were elected, of course, by the people and whatnot, established that, that they clearly thought it was a problem, and therefore they established the budget cap. I mean, given that, I mean, you passed the buck back to Congress, I wonder, can't we all agree it's a problem if all of our elected officials, Democratic and Republican alike, agree it's a problem? I mean, I appreciate the nature of special interest or factions or a democracy as heirs to fire, but it just strikes me that it's obviously a problem. I mean, if there's such narrow special interests get to dictate federal policy or have such an outsized influence.
Well, again, I would return to the fact that I don't think this is a problem that has anything to do with settlements. To the extent there's a problem, it has everything to do with litigation and that these settlements, it is a fantasy to think that the Fish and Wildlife Service would have more control over its priorities if it didn't enter these settlements. If they didn't enter the settlements, they would have much less control over their priorities because they would be facing injunctions from 13 different judges across the country.
Oh, no, I agree 100%. I'm just saying, I guess
right.
It's different...
That's not about settlements. That's about the structure of the law and the fact that Congress has required them to do a lot of things and given them very few resources. Now, I don't know about the particular bill you're referring. I don't know whether it was part of a larger overriding appropriations bill. I just don't.
Indeed.
So I can't opine on... What was that?
Indeed, it was FY 2012.
Okay, so if it was part of the overarching appropriations bill, then I'm not sure I read much into that about the various perspectives of Congress. I think that Congress bundles lots of issues that are really important to a few people and not important to other people into appropriations bills, and if no one objects too strongly, we try not to shut down the government.
Which is,
it was requested by the Fish and Wildlife Service. They did deliberate on it. They did pass it. I would just note that I guess the only difference is we're seeing the same problem. I see the settlements as a manifestation of the underlying dynamics about which I spoke, this unfortunate interplay between too many responsibilities and agency forcing suits. I think it's problematic. The settlement isolated unto itself in a vacuum perhaps is not, but I do think it's indicative of a public policy problem.
Well, I mean, it's a problem that Congress hasn't given the agencies the resources they need to complete the tasks that Congress has entrusted to them. And, I mean, I think it's fair, and so we can argue.
Indeed, that's one of the
two. We want to talk about, right, so we could either talk about giving the agencies more authority or more power, more money, or we can talk about changing the substantive requirements under the ESA. I think those are
the two. That's not reasonable, though, to simply say more resources, more resources, more resources isn't the world we live in. I mean, limited resources is an inherent function of all federal agencies. Of course, they'd like billions and billions of more dollars. So given the limited resources and given the overwhelming number of responsibilities, it seems perhaps, you know, that a fix such as the budget cap or perhaps even removing the citizen supervision or limiting it in some other fashion doesn't sound beyond the pale. I mean, that seems like a more specific, plausible policy solution than just print more money.
Well, and as I said, I didn't say just print more money. I said we could have two debates. One is about printing more money, and the other is about limiting the obligations of the agency under the statute. To me, neither of those have anything to do with settlements. And the existing legislation, like the ESA Settlement Reform Act, which has been proposed by Senator Cornyn, specifically targets settlements and tries to restrict the ability of the federal government to enter settlements. That strikes me as an absurd approach to this problem, right? If you limit the power of the government to enter settlements, all you're doing is reducing the ability of agencies to manage their priorities and increasing the amount of fees that they're going to be paying at the end of the day.
Well, gentlemen, let's check in with another audience member if that's okay with you.
Of course.
This is Karen Lugo from Texas Federalist Society. I recently have been involved in a position where I talked with various agencies across many states. And one of the concerns with this situation, and this is to unsettle relative to EPA as well as endangered species, but the fact that the state did not have standing generally. Comptroller Combs had kind of a unique situation with the fact that she held permits and therefore was allowed to intervene. So it looks like Congress may be about to address this aspect of the issue with a bill by Senator Cornyn and a companion bill by Representative Flores in the House, which they say would give states and counties facing regulation a seat at the table. So if this does mean standing, what would any of you say as to how significant a reform this would be and the likelihood of enough support in Congress that this would pass?
Let me respond to that because Fish and Wildlife, I heard, was maybe not going to defend the suit on the lizard. And I had made it clear that if the Texas Conservation Plan was challenged, we would enter into a vigorous defense. And I think almost any public entity, state or whatever, would enter into a vigorous defense, which I think is good for everybody, which means that you would then be able to flesh out the science, be able to flesh out the options. But if Fish and Wildlife in a challenge to a not warranted doesn't even challenge that, then you're basically ending up with any decision that's not warranted is going to be ending up a decision to list. And I think that's the worst of all possible worlds.
I was going to say very briefly, Congress forcing federal agencies to grant, or courts, I should say, to grant states and perhaps even private parties intervention of right, to me is a bigger issue for cooperative federalism regulatory regimes, like the Clean Water Act and Clean Air Act, where there's been a troubling pattern of EPA, federal agencies actually, or EPA in particular, litigating to prevent state participation either by intervention or through participation in the negotiation settlement talks, despite the fact that states are regulated entities and despite the fact that it's a cooperative federalism regime to begin with. But to the extent that the Fish and Wildlife Service is litigating, to the extent to which states are trying to intervene and they're being opposed by federal agencies, that would bother me and that would perhaps create an impetus for this particular legislative solution. I've only come across in my admittedly limited research of these settlement agreements, the non-super settlement agreements, of private parties or private industry trying to intervene. And usually the ones I've seen, the Fish and Wildlife Service doesn't take a position, but that such intervention is opposed by the environmental plaintiffs.
Well, let me say, but Fish and Wildlife was happy to have me intervene. I don't mean that. The problem would be it's a question of whether or not I would have had standing. As it turned out, CBD did not oppose, but again, I held the permit. And it is actually, it was rare, as Ms. Lugo pointed out, it was rare for a state to just, without holding a permit, to be granted intervener status based on the research that I did.
Professor Padot, do you have a comment here?
I think there's an interesting question about federal courts, and there's a split of authority as to whether or not intervention requires standing. So I think that's one sort of placeholder to put down. I'm not sure whether Congress can get involved that much. I mean, to the extent courts are conceiving this as a question of Article III jurisdiction, which I think some of them do, then an effort by Congress to expand the scope of rights of intervention may be futile. I don't know. I think that's a fascinating question, but now I'm putting on my academic hat. That's the sort of thing I would like to think about and write about, and I don't know what I think of at the moment. I think, my experience at DOJ was very much that, by and large, the federal government does not get involved in intervention disputes. Usually it's between plaintiffs and intervener defendants. They do sometimes, and they certainly do at the point that they're trying to settle cases. And I think the justification there has nothing to do with trying to keep people out. It has to do with trying to streamline the process. The process for settling, if you're the federal government, is already incredibly onerous. Almost all settlement authority is vested in the Associate Attorney General. It's the number three person at the Department of Justice, which means if you, a staff attorney, are recommending settlement, you have to write a memo that's going to go through about 15 levels of review and end up on the associate's office, associate's desk, and it is a nightmare, right? I mean, when I was in the appellate section, it was twice as easy to litigate a case to the merits as to try to enter into a settlement. And so I think there are already a lot of institutional checks on settlements, and the government is concerned, rightly or wrongly, about increasing what is already a very burdensome process, and that will simply make settlement virtually impossible and thereby eliminate some of the advantages which the government thinks it can get from settling a case and thereby reaching a compromise rather than letting a judge simply dictate the result.
We've got just a couple minutes left and one patient caller with a question remaining, so let's try and get this final question in here.
This is R.J. Smith with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and I have a brief response to the moderator's original question as to whether there is cost-benefit analysis or any economic considerations that take place in the listing of a species. And the answer to that is no. I mean, in the Endangered Species Act, it says that decisions of listing are to be made solely on the basis of the science, or the best available data, and there are no economic considerations. And that was underscored in the first big court case, TVA v. Hill, in 1978, when a small fish, a snail darter, was found in the Little Tennessee River. And completion of the $100 million Tellico Dam would have supposedly caused it to go extinct. And the court ruled 6-3 for the ESA, underscoring the fact that it was the clear intent of Congress when they passed the act that every listed species must be protected, no matter what the cost. So it couldn't be any more clear than that. And I think the only place where economic considerations come in is in the designation of critical habitat. And even there, they're given, I think, fairly short shrift. And that's it.
Thank you so much for that. Any comments from, and we can take final remarks now since we're just about out of time, from our panelists?
I mean, I generally agree with that. This is Professor Padot. I think that during the last Bush administration, there were some efforts at Fish and Wildlife to inject economic considerations into some of the listing decisions. Largely, those failed in the courts. The TVA versus Hill case is about a separate question, not listing. It's about Section 7's ban on on federal projects that cause jeopardy. But the overall sentiment that the commenter just made, I think, is exactly right. The ESA was designed as an absolute protection for species from extinction, and economics, Congress didn't think at the time, should figure in a particularly meaningful way.
Mr. Yeatman or Ms. Combs?
No, that's why they call it the pit bull of statutes, or environmental statutes.
I would add one other thing. There's a new policy being thought about by Fish and Wildlife about when you are going ahead and determining critical habitat. The theory now is you don't have to do a new economic impact statement or economic look because, in fact, it's already been priced in by the time it's listed, which I find a little bizarre and probably not true.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to let that be our final word. This has been a spirited discussion. I want to thank our panelists, the Honorable Susan Combs, Professor Justin Pideaux, and William Yeatman. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. I want to thank the audience as well for your participation, your listening, and your questions. A reminder to our audience about our next Teleform conference call, which is scheduled for Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll be talking about Too Big to Fail and Single Point of Entry. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.